Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 3 of Journeys, a podcast on transportation. I'm your host, Mateo, and today we're joined by Skylar Bison-Rapp. Skylar is a senior associate at the Practice for Architecture and Urbanism, PAU, where he has worked on projects ranging from storefront cultural spaces to neighborhood scale master plans. Skylar was also formerly a member of the adjunct facility at Columbia University Graduate School for Architecture Planning and Preservation. Hi, Skylar, how are you?
Hi, Mateo. I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. So I'd kind of like to start with maybe an overall kind of grand scale question. I know it's quite broad, but I ask this to every guest before we start. And the question is, what should a city be? Who should it serve? What's its purpose? What makes cities remarkable? I know it's, you know, very broad, but I'm just kind of curious your overall take on our, you know, contemporary urban environments.
Yeah, it's a great question. You mentioned I was an adjunct at Columbia. The class that I taught with PAU founder Vishant Chakrabarty was called Theories of City Form, and it was really focused on exactly that question. What should cities be? I think assumes that we have kind of absolute agency as to what they are, as opposed to, you know, why they look the way they do. And then people asking those questions historically have been obsessed with this idea of the ideal city, right? And the ideal city notions of utopia are really pretty deeply connected. So it's a great question. I think that there are two kind of main ways that people have approached this question historically, right? Either, and they're, you know, pure types that obviously don't exist, in the real world, in such siloed ways. But there's the idea that cities are kind of economic machines, right? That either need to be designed for efficiency, or if you're kind of a free marketer, naturally emerge efficiently. Grand debates about how that works and the role of regulation on those mechanics, kind of, you know, perhaps most famously in this country around Houston and the lack of zoning, and whether or not that outcome is efficient, and whether those, you know, markets are naturally occurring or are actually bounded by other factors. It's kind of a deeper debate. The other side of the coin is that cities occur in special places for, you know, almost mystical or supernatural reasons, which is not to say that it's, you know, kind of like a religious inquiry so much as that there are places that are important to people. And those places, for whatever reason, throughout time, that importance sort of reinforces itself as a node, which is why, you know, places that might be similar for geographic reasons don't manifest in exactly the same way, right? And obviously the reality is somewhere in between those two things. The idea that we can separate human economic culture from other parts of human culture is a very kind of modernist idea. And if you look back to pre-modern times, those distinctions didn't exist. So, you know, one example of kind of classical planning that's thrown around for kind of pure rationality, you think about the Roman grid and the Cardo and the Deco and, you know, military efficiency and everything else. That was overlaid with, kind of deeply emotional ideas about replicating Rome in every Roman city, the idea that every Roman can see these repeating factors all over the empire and know that they're always in Rome, wherever they are. I mean, even the way that the cities were founded was sort of deeply mystical, involved something called the Ritus Etruscus, where they, every time they founded a new city, they actually reenacted the mythological founding of Rome. So, you know, that's a really kind of simple allegory for how you can't separate those things, right? And that, I think, gets kind of deep into the philosophy of how we work as urbanists and designers, thinking about, you know, oftentimes our clients, our private sector clients, they're interested in value, but value and urban culture are kind of deeply related. So to get back to your main question of what a city should be and what an ideal city should look like, I think, you know, what's core to our practice at PAU is that cities are, you know, by people and for people. There was a philosopher, a French philosopher in the 60s, Henri Lefebvre, who had this idea of the right to the city. and kind of at the core of that, from my perspective, is this idea that it's people and human culture that create value in cities, and that value is what drives cities to be built. And so, you know, trying to come up with systems that recognize that in a more democratic way, because certainly having an ownership stake in a legal sense does not make you any more or less invested in making a city if you live in one. So, you know, the ideal city, I think, more fairly recognizes who's contributing.
That's fascinating. And I'd like to kind of go back to the original kind of definition you gave, that there's two views, that cities are either economic machines that are made for maximum productivity, or cities are, you know, important to people and they kind of manifest themselves in these, I think you said, mystical ways. And I'm curious, you said, you know, there's kind of a middle ground, and I'm wondering if you kind of go more into what that middle ground looks like, or kind of how they convalesce cities getting created for economic means, but then also existing because they're, you know, important to people.
Yeah, I mean, I think even if you just look at New York, right, which is where you're at, the subject of this interview, at least, you know, you can trace, you know, New York is located where it is because of a natural harbor, right? That's the easy answer to why it is the tip of an island at, you know, arguably the best natural harbor on the eastern seaboard. It doesn't explain why it grew so fast, right? The explosion of growth in New York City can be traced to the opening of the Erie Canal, right? Before railroads in the early 19th century, New York was the point of access to the entire heartland of the North American continent. The Erie Canal, of course, connects the Hudson to the Great Lakes, and the Great Lakes were connected to the whole Mississippi Delta at, not surprisingly, the portage that was known as Chicago before the canals and the railroads were built there, right? So you have two geographic points that link up basically all of the waterways in North America to the Atlantic seaboard and the European powers across the ocean. And you get the rationalization for the 19th century explosions of New York and Chicago. But, you know, that's not all that there is to these places, right? They're not purely mercantile endeavors, right? Otherwise, you might say that they would be identical or very similar, or the differences between them would only be due to their, you know, slightly different sort of economic purposes, right? You know, one for portage, the other for breaking down seafaring ships into barges. But these places take on meanings of their own that aren't just economic rationalizations, right? And I think New York and Chicago both have pretty deep kind of mythologies around, you know, their culture and what they mean as places that have lives of their own outside of their primary industries. So, you know, I that might be the kind of most succinct way of putting it, right? And so you can't, those cultures wouldn't exist without the economic rationale that supports them. But at the same time, you can't understand the city only by the economic rationale. And in fact, you know, especially in sort of contemporary analysis, when you're looking at what makes cities attractive places to live, you know, oftentimes it's the sort of culture and the way of understanding living in the city that attracts people to them. You know, you can argue that Dallas has just as dynamic of an economy as New York, sure. But you know, people, and I don't mean to call out Dallas, but it's famous for being a sort of boring city. I've been there; it's not a terrible place. Sure. But the idea that you need a sort of a dynamic culture to attract talent, in addition to a robust economy, I think is the way a lot of contemporary, you know, theorists of market-based cities are looking at things today.
So there's a lot of great things there, and I wrote some of them down for us to come back to, especially when we talk about 15-minute city and cities of living space. But I'd like to kind of start with some other broad questions, and this one is maybe the broadest, but, you know, how are current cities planned, and specifically New York City? You know, I know we're going to talk about the car and the vehicle and how that kind of shapes the urban landscape, but, you know, right now, what do we prioritize in our urban spaces?
So New York is famously not very planned. There was, you know, the 1811 commissioner's grid for Manhattan that laid out the blocks. You know, at the time, the urbanization didn't go much above 14th Street, which is why the grid starts to become so much more regular beyond it. There wasn't very much there in 1811, and it was kind of this amazing act of hubris to say, we're just going to lay out this grid sort of all the way up the island. It was realized pretty close to that, with the exception of Central Park, which was added subsequently, before they got to developing the whole thing, but subsequent to the invention of the plan. New York didn't originate the concept of zoning, but had the first sort of comprehensive zoning plan. But a zoning plan, of course, is not a master plan. Zoning sets out the parameters by which buildings can be built, but it doesn't talk about the arrangement of roads or anything else. You know, part of this is that New York was consolidated, right? Famously in 1899, New York City takes over the other boroughs. So that there were a lot of existing factors there. But I think it's also the you know, in some ways contradicting myself, the mercantile culture of New York that really kind of led people to think that it was the private sector that should be driving the way things are developed. There are some exceptions to that, of course, urban renewal, Robert Moses, there's a long history of government interventions, but they weren't planned comprehensively with an eye towards the city as a whole place, right? So Moses had a sort of regional idea about transportation. Housing was kind of secondary. It was a way of getting more federal money. The Regional Plan Association, of course, has released 4 regional plans, but they are a nonprofit. That's not a binding document. It's, mm-hmm. you know, aspirational. So, you know, the city not only doesn't have a master plan, but hasn't really done a comprehensive zoning update in half a century, right? 1961 was the last time they changed the code. So it's only been changed once since it was adopted in 1914. So when we talk about the way the city's planned, the city, New York City's really planned at the neighborhood level. City planning does do neighborhood plans. They do neighborhood rezonings. So, you know, the zoning code is amended lot by lot by private application through what's called the Uniform Land Use Review Process, or ULURP. The city will take on its own ULURPs for neighborhood scale projects. So, you know, Hudson Yards was rezoned comprehensively. Long Island City 10 years ago was rezoned comprehensively. There's one right now for Gowanus that they released a framework plan, which is not a binding legal document. It kind of puts a bunch of ideas out there for public comment. At some point, conceivably, there will be a comprehensive rezoning for Gowanus based on that. So, you know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? That sort of remains to be seen. It's a very large territory to try to plan comprehensively. There are some loose ideas about central business districts that inform lower level decisions. New York supposedly has 4. There's downtown, midtown, downtown Brooklyn, and Long Island City. Ideas that these are centers of business. Transportation planning, of course, happens holistically, right? That's a system, but there's not one master plan that's taking all of these inputs and sort of creating a grand vision for New York.
So then, you know, maybe I'd like to adjust my question and say, maybe they're not grand plans or structures that, you know, an override authority figure, you know, like the government structures, but, you know, then what factors maybe shape the landscape most predominantly? You know, I'm thinking cars, certain economic factors, but I'm wondering, like, what maybe uncontrollable factors kind of shape the space we live in?
So there's a number of them, and they're deeply interrelated, right? So there's zoning, right, which governs what can legally be built, but that's a legal constraint, right? It can be changed, so you can, you know, through this process, amend how much the city allows you to build. There's building code, which is you know, more generic, less political, although there's a lot of influence of the sort of construction materials industry. If you want to dig down into that, that's the shape of buildings and how they come together. New York has requirements for legal light and air for residences, which date back to reform era laws governing tenements. Then there's land value, right? Land value is deeply related to zoning, right? Because if the amount you can build determines how much the land is worth, then you know you're going to have a sort of a relationship there. There's transportation infrastructure, right? New York is arguably less impacted by automobiles than other cities, because at least North American cities, because it's got arguably the best public transportation network in North America. The flip side of that is that then land values are related to public transit access. So, you know, most New Yorkers don't want to walk more than a quarter of a mile to get to a subway station. Very spoiled by pretty much all other accounts. So there's a relationship then between transportation and land value. And there's a relationship theoretically between zoning and transportation capacity from just sort of a best practice standpoint, right? You want to locate density near transportation capacity to kind of balance your load, right? You don't want to upzone a neighborhood near an overburdened subway line unless there's potential to increase capacity there. So those are the types of questions that planners evaluate when they're looking at upzoning. Now, of course, there's a political layer to that too, right? There's a fair amount of transportation capacity in and around Park Slope, Brooklyn. And yet famously Park Slope was downzoned towards the end of the Bloomberg administration. And before, you know, we heap all of the blame on Bloomberg, de Blasio being a Park Sloper was not about to overturn that either. So, you know, it's a famously well organized and affluent neighborhood that's able to advocate for ideas about neighborhood character. And I put that in quotes, not because it's not a real thing, but because who gets to define that is a sort of hotly contested political ground. And what neighborhood character is more valuable than other neighborhood characters is sort of a big question. So if you've got economics and politics driving the kind of framework around where density can go alongside sort of technical constraints around transportation capacity and building construction technology.
So, you know, from this, I'm wondering if we could transition to the PAL, Not Your Car proposal, if you could speak a little bit about that. And you could speak a little bit about it and talk about its implications and kind of the main intention behind putting that plan out into the world and maybe even at the end, its feasibility.
Sure. So, you know, I think this is in a lot of ways related to the questions that we were talking about before. You know, the plan we put forward to, you know, ban all cars from Manhattan is not a new idea. It was proposed as early as the 60s by Percival and John Goodman, I believe. Let's see if I'm getting, no, it's Percival Goodman. Paul Goodman, I apologize. Percival and Paul Goodman in 61. But I think, you know, we were revisiting it now because there was kind of a moment of break around COVID, right? The plan is not a plan that's like a, you know, a COVID retrofit of the city. The plan is looking at the city with fresh eyes because of the way that the pandemic changed the way that we inhabit cities, right? So vehicular traffic decreased, at least initially, and people were really desperate for access to public space that they could get to without taking public transit, because people weren't taking public transit either. And so all of a sudden streets started being closed. New York's program actually was less ambitious than some. And Oakland famously, you know, really went to it in terms of street closures for recreation space. But nevertheless, you know, you could go out onto the street and sort of see these big expanses of pavement. You could see people kind of walking you know, with disregard for sidewalks in a way that they, you know, never would have dared before. And what that kind of raised in our minds was something that we knew, I think, academically already, but didn't feel, couldn't really feel in a tangible way before that, which is that streets and the way that they're used is a, sort of a deeply acculturated thing, right? And it's acculturated to cars, even though New York isn't as dependent on cars as other places, you know, famously low ownership, car ownership rates. The way that we view streets and the territory of streets is still entirely based around the car, such that there's this sense that streets are for cars, right? Which is a sentence that sounds obvious until you realize that streets as places are much, much older than automobiles, right? Significantly so. You know, not only do they predate cars, they predate, I mean, it is very hard to find human settlements that do not have dedicated rights of way. Whether they're legally protected or not is another question, but you know, the settlements that don't have some form of street are the exception to the rule. That's sort of a global universal to the extent that there is one. The way that people think about streets can be different in different places, but there's always spaces between buildings. And those are generally used for getting around. If you look at the way that streets are occupied prior to automobiles, it's quite different, right? You know, curbs, to the extent to which they existed, were higher for sanitary reasons, not for separating cars out. And pedestrians just kind of mingled in the streets. I mean, you can go look at historic photographs of New York in, you know, horse and buggy days. And, you know, yes, there was vehicular traffic, but it navigated seas of people because the speed was much lower. All this to say that, you know, streets end up being a huge both spatial and economic subsidy for automobiles, right? The ability to use an automobile in the city is entirely dependent on the city laying out that space and providing that infrastructure for that use to happen. And, you know, that is mutually reinforcing with the way that people think about streets and occupy them, the idea that sidewalks are for pedestrians and the rest of this, you know, average 60-foot wide right away for a common street is for cars. So we were thinking about all these ideas at the same time that Farhad Manju, the columnist for the New York Times, was looking at, you know, things that are driving the future of cities. He was doing a series, not unlike your podcast, I suppose. And there was sort of this this kind of alignment. We'd worked with the Times before on our proposal for Penn Station in a similar capacity where we were doing design work that was informing an editorial and providing imagery and animations for it. And so we did another such endeavor for this. And so, you know, I think what we were trying to illustrate was, you know, not that cars are inherently bad or that they need to be completely abolished, but that private vehicle ownership, you know, really is a big imposition on our cities. And I think when we're at a moment where we're talking so much about equity and who has access to cities, you know, thinking about where our kind of common spatial priorities lie, examining the way that we, you know, literally make space for cars, I think is a really kind of interesting point of interrogation.
And so I'd like to kind of maybe go into some more specifics, you know, of the plan itself. But, you know, first I really do, I really like your description of, you know, what streets used to be, because, you know, I remember seeing images and learning about, you know, what the street used to mean for the community, where there would be markets. And I think I say this in almost every podcast, but it was a place where the community would meet, and you would have markets mm-hmm. open, and little buggies would go through, and kids would play. And kind of as soon as the, you know, the Henry Ford comes along, the Model T and private vehicle ownership becomes quite common, that, yeah, the streets do start to get ruled by the vehicle. And so, you know, speaking about that, for Powell's proposal, when looking at the actual, I know we can't show images on the podcast, it's just audio, but looking at the visuals you provide in the plan, it looks like the street's totally reimagined. So I'm wondering if you could talk about the bike lanes and kind of what would this kind of, if this came to be, what would this transformation mean for the, you know, everyday Manhattan neighborhood?
Yeah, I mean, I think we debated a lot about how prescriptive we wanted to be with these reimaginings. And I think I don't know how much it came across, but what our goal was for it to be a provocation about, you know, what's possible, right? If you don't need all of that space, right? So if you have, break this down, you've got a typical 60-foot right of way, you know, you've got, let's say, 10-foot sidewalks on either side, and then roughly, you know, four 10-foot wide lanes in different places. You might have slightly wider sidewalks or slightly narrower sidewalks. Mm-hmm. But, you know, basically you're gaining a net of somewhere between 20 and 30 feet extra space, taking away parking lanes, right? Because we're still, you know, you need vehicular access for emergency vehicles and for drop-offs and for accessibility reasons and other things. But if you have no private vehicles, you need much less parking, right? You can have dedicated drop-off zones, space for deliveries. And, you know, what our transportation engineers that we're working with told us is that if you have less private vehicles, you have less traffic demand. So you can lose lanes there as well, right? So the kind of core of the proposal is the idea that we're freeing up space in the public realm, right? Streets are public, the space in them is public, and the decision on how that space is used, you know, is a political and cultural decision. And so thinking about streets as a space of potential rather than something that has to be laid out for the free flowing of, you know, automotive traffic, I think was the jumping off point. So, you know, bicycles were something that, you know, was kind of a focus in that, you know, it's something that the city is doing a better job providing infrastructure for now than it has historically, but of course could do better. More space for pedestrians, more kind of unprogrammed space for recreation and just, you know, kind of passing the time in the street. And then space for other uses, you know, be it social services, the idea that, you know, mental health and homeless service outreach, you know, needs spaces on the street. Street vending is a highly contested topic in this city, both presently and going back a long ways. And a lot of that contestation, at least on its face, is about the politics of space, right? And there being a premium on space and what looks neat and orderly and what doesn't. And so when you kind of open up and free space for other things, I think that it kind of changes the paradigm for that. You can have dedicated spaces on every block for vending, that really kind of disarm some of the arguments around street vending, which is a big equity issue as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think what we tried to illustrate with the examples that we put out there was just potentials for different types of streets in the city in different neighborhoods, rather than saying that there was one kind of ideal type. And I think that, you know, if this were to be put into practice, there would, you know, be a lot of discussion, and, you know, we think kind of most appropriately at the neighborhood level as to how that space wants to be used. You asked also about implementation.
It was more just about its feasibility, or if there was any sense that when you were pulling up the plan that there are parts that could actually be put into action, or is this more kind of a grand vision for what it could be if, you know, we had. Yeah, I am curious kind of the, I think
so. That's my question. Yeah, so we were very adamant that we wanted this we were very adamant that it is feasible and that we wanted to illustrate it as such, right? So our proposal is decidedly not tied to autonomous vehicles. It's not tied to needing, you know, any kind of new technology really other than paint. you know, restriping lanes, changing, you know, signal timing, new signage, maybe, you know, there would be a cost, but the cost would be relatively low. You know, there is a broader kind of economic impact calculus that we didn't want to wade into because it gets tremendously complicated very fast. The public transit in New York City is very financially dependent on tolls from the bridges. So that's one thing that a naysayer could very quickly point to and say, well, like, you're going to bankrupt public transit by, you know, depriving them of private vehicle tolling on the bridges. Mm. But, you know, you've got that on the one hand, compared to, you know, literally tens or hundreds of millions of dollars of lost productivity of workers being stuck in traffic, which would theoretically, you know, be improved. There was some studies that our transportation engineer did on how banning private vehicle traffic from Manhattan would actually drastically increase the flow of traffic in the surrounding boroughs and counties, just because the bridge approaches become bottlenecks. So drivers outside of Manhattan would theoretically be would benefit, stand to benefit from banning private vehicles in Manhattan. And the other aspect of it is improving the feasibility of buses. You know, buses all over have, or at least in the United States, have somewhat of a stigma attached to them around class and around age oftentimes. But part of that is that, you know, and you were mentioning that your uncle worked on the BRT routes in Mexico City, is that without designing streets for buses, right, buses can be incredibly inefficient. And if they're not well planned and they don't come regularly, you know, using them isn't great. So freeing up space on the street for buses, as well as increasing speeds for buses outside, you know, would theoretically allow for a big expansion of bus public transit in New York at rates that were competitive with the subway. So you'd have, and you know, knowing how the fare structure works in New York, increased ridership with a much lower overhead for expanding capacity than on the subway. So there were a lot of, you know, levers. I mean, there was, we talked about traffic violations. The police makes a lot of money on moving violations and parking fines that they wouldn't, you know, be able to have. So we didn't want to get too far down the rabbit hole into economic feasibility. You'd really need a pretty detailed study to get into that. But none of that we think is really insurmountable. You know, we wanted to get out of an austerity mindset where saying that, hey, maybe we need to dedicate more tax revenue to public transportation instead of having it be dependent on tolls. You know, all of that really is fundamentally a political question. And so what we were trying to argue for was that the only real limits on feasibility are, you know, is the public imagination and the sort of political appetite for doing something that is considered radical. But, you know, we would argue far less radical than the wholesale demolition of neighborhoods that took place in the mid 20th century building. So, you know, we radically reimagine cities, you know, every generation or so. You know, it seemed like a decent time to revisit our assumptions about streets.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, yeah, one can only think of, you know, the Cross Bronx expressway and what happened in the Bronx, you know, to radically reimagining cities. And you know, something interesting is that, you know, I'll hear from my professor sometime or, you know, who people know a lot about urban planning, especially even regard to this proposal, that, you know, they would always say, oh, the Chinese are willing to do it, as if, you know, this kind of this mentality that grand scale change is only possible in emerging economies. And, you know, that energy that maybe we had in the early 20th century is kind of gone. But, you know, not that I believe in that. And, you know, something I want to quickly talk about before we move on to the next question is maybe more like the social aspect or the aspect of, you know, how would people's lives change if we can imagine Manhattan in this way? I mean, I just imagine it being a much more friendly or sociable place to be. I feel like the car in and of itself kind of constrains the individual to being within one's family, one's close-knit group, and you kind of are isolated in this metal box. And, you know, growing up in even in Berkeley, where it is quite suburban, the car is really relied on. In New York City, I've had so many marvelous experiences in public transportation or out on the street when things are open. And it seems like public transportation, in a way, is almost a complement to the Open Streets program, because you're not going and getting and you're not constrained in a little box. You're still open, interacting with people. And so, you know, I'm curious what you think about people's everyday lives, not in terms of getting from place to place, but how it could just overall increase interaction.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the famous line. I think it's Don Cheadle in Crash, where he talks about Los Angeles and Angelenos being isolated because they're in these boxes and they're separated from each other by steel and glass. And it's not until they crash into each other that they can recognize their own humanity or something like that. And you know, it's a corny line, but there is some truth to it. I think that there's kind of two parts to this. In New York, I think that the transformation is less about getting out of cars, because most New Yorkers are already out of cars, right? It's something that, you know, we talk about in our office as positive social friction, this idea that you actually don't want to be able to be purely autonomous and move through space without any obstacles, that there's some amount of jostling that is actually desirable, both in terms of neighborhood culture, but also economically and everything else. So I think, you know, Manhattan can only stand to gain, and New York can only stand to gain from increases in that, but it certainly wouldn't be a radical transformation in that front, and that we're already doing that, right? The kind of positioning of this piece in Manhattan, it's almost more of a removing of an imposition. The ownership rates of cars in Manhattan are quite low. Those who do own cars tend to be very, very wealthy. And a huge percentage of the traffic is people commuting by car who tend to be on the wealthier side as well. And so it's kind of removing the negative externalities of making that lifestyle possible for everyone else in the borough. So, you know, I think the specific examples that came out of this were that, you know, a lot of the transportation infrastructure, specifically the FDR, tends to run by some of the few remaining affordable neighborhoods in Manhattan, you know, on the Lower East Side, Chinatown, Two Bridges, and then up, you know, the Far East Side and East Harlem. All of those are communities that, you know, there has been progress made in giving them access to the East River waterfront, but especially where the FDR runs at grade, it's completely cut off. So there's a big potential to improve access to park space there. And then I think, you know, we kind of already touched on some of the other ideas around just opening spaces of potential for other uses. I think though your broader point about getting people out of cars is kind of more potent when we're thinking about how this could be applied elsewhere, right? You know, there was a lot of question around, do we keep our proposal bounded to Manhattan, or do we, you know, talk about it in other places or kind of broader in the five boroughs? And we kept it to Manhattan just because it was concise. It's easier to explain. It also just lended itself to, you know, being a bounded proposal. We didn't want it to expand endlessly. It gets more complicated in other boroughs that don't have as good of transit access. There are, you know, big parts of the Bronx and Queens and outer Brooklyn that are car dependent, right? You know, they live in New York, but the nearest subway station is a mile and a half away. The bus service doesn't go the right way or runs too infrequently. And so I think that the way that you need to approach something like this in that kind of a context, let alone a context, you know, of a different city that had little to no public transportation infrastructure, which is, you know, really the state of affairs in lots of North American cities, is quite different. And I think it starts to get at the wholesale changes you need to make to enable not necessarily a car-free lifestyle, but a less car-dependent lifestyle. I think one thing we wanted to get at here is that, like, there's nothing wrong with, you know, taking a cab or an Uber every once in a while, especially if you needed to get around. But the idea that a more well-functioning city at a more sustainable and arguably more culturally enjoyable level of density requires a rethinking of our kind of day-to-day relationship with automobiles.
So does a less car dependent society mean a society that's more dependent on the walking radius of a neighborhood? And yeah, if that's the case, then you know, that's a wholesale reimagining of how we live in our cities, right? I mean, I know we spoke about this earlier, I mentioned it, but you know, the 15-minute city concept, for example, you know, that is that kind of the ideal for a society that's less dependent on individual automobiles?
I think it's a great, easy to explain example. You know, whether 15 minutes is always the most appropriate radius or, you know, how we define daily needs versus other things, right? There's obviously a lot of nuance to that. But yes, in general, I think it's very much the right direction. You know, the way that, and this could, you know, we've got multiple, you know, 2-hour lectures on this subject in our class, but the way that the spatial patterning of mid to late 20th century cities is influenced by cars, and the way that those land use patterns change the way we think about space is dramatic, right? And it's leads to these, you know, very spread out mono uses, which are both inefficient and to your point, I think work against social cohesion and solidarity, right? You're kind of isolated, you live in a pod, which is not to say that you know, single family houses or kind of less dense environments are inherently bad. There are plenty of examples of, you know, walkable, less dense neighborhoods. They do tend to have to be more dense than, you know, kind of exurban sprawl. But I think there's still a range, there's still room within a 15-minute city framework for a lot of different types of kind of human environments. That said, things like single-use zoning are problematic, right? I mean, you need to have a much kind of finer grain of land planning to get to the point where, you know, you can have corner stores again, that they're viable, right? And it generally means, you know, you get a, you end up needing a more dense fabric to make that possible, right? That's where these things start to become mutually dependent. If you're talking about the population that can economically support a small corner store within a walking radius, right? You know, that's going to be directly correlated to the density of the development around it. Does it need to all be, you know, 30-story apartment buildings? No, but you know, can everybody have a 4-acre lot? Like, probably not. So, you know, I think that there's obviously room for a range of things, but if we're interested in getting away from cars for economic reasons, for equity reasons, for environmental reasons, then, you know, we do have to think differently about density and about planning.
So
before we can start talking about banning cars from streets, right?
Sure.
You obviously can't ban cars from streets in places where people are dependent on cars for literally every activity of their, you know, waking life.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And, you know, clearly that another public transportation, all these things would, you know, would come as well. But, you know, so our time is up at this point. So I really just want to thank you again for joining me And it has been a really fascinating conversation. So I really, really appreciate it.
Of course, it was fun.